Welcome to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. Each week, Jared will speak one-on-one with Department of Defense senior managers discussing policies and programs affecting warfighters and how the military meets its mission. On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for joining us this week. We start this week's show with some ongoing developments at the Defense Intelligence Agency, as the agency rolls out a plan to change the way it interacts with industry and brings innovation into government. Later in the hour, an update from Air Force Space Command about that service's activities in cyberspace. First up, though, at the Defense Intelligence Agency, Dan Doney, the agency's new chief innovation officer, wants to shake up the way DIA brings new technology on board, and to do it quickly, with acquisition cycle times of around 30 days. At its core is something DIA is calling the Open Innovation Gateway. DIA wants to extend the IT environment it operates in every day to private industry, academics, or anyone else who might be able to contribute critical technologies. Innovators will be able to showcase their capabilities directly to users, and likewise, users will be able to catalog exactly what they need to do their jobs in a wiki-like environment. The agency hopes to launch the project sometime around the end of this calendar year. Doney spoke with us during DIA's 2013 Innovation Day at the agency's headquarters at Joint Base Anacostia Bowling here in Washington.
If you roll all the way back to the beginning of the agency, we were established as an organization to understand the plans of our adversaries. So in the process of doing this, understanding their plans, we were an organization that really focuses on planning. Planning is planning and sticking to the plan is the opposite of innovation, right? So innovation is deviating from the plan, we're rapidly moving it and changing. So you can understand, based on our roots, not even a reluctance, just an unnatural match between that core and a rapid, fast-moving, changing environment. That was yesterday. Today, we have leadership committed to change. We understand, especially with our mission where we must understand strategic surprise, the importance of being on top of change, to harness change, to embrace change. And so that's really driving the whole strategy, where we're building agility into the core of what we do. Now, the basis for that is a very different relationship with industry, all the idea providers across the board, industry, academia, and other partnerships. For us to harness the best of what's out there, we need new ways to interact that are really based on a friction-free environment.
And I think the key is the Open Innovation Gateway. Talk a little bit about where that idea came from and what it is.
Yes. So the idea was inspired by a set of challenges that I had in while I was at IARPA. Within any advanced R&D organization is familiar with what people call the Valley of Death. That is, when good ideas are created in innovative environments, it is very difficult to bridge the Valley of Death and get them into enterprise organizations, again, where the enterprise is usually driven by a long-run and strategic plan. So what you need to develop, and the idea really came from, something called Bridge, which was a systematic way to connect those ideas from the outside into the enterprise. So rather than the enterprise and innovation competing, they're cooperating, working together. Now, that can be extended not just to advanced R&D environments, but also to the rest of industry. So that's the model. That's where it came from. So it's a new approach, frankly, to tapping into the best ideas, not taking the ideas, morphing them, and converting them to the enterprise, but rather taking it in the opposite direction, bringing the enterprise and its characteristics to the innovator to allow the innovator to build on top of, around the basic elements such that they're complementing one another instead of competing.
And talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of how this will work. I mean, how do these outside innovators get access to DIA's IT environment? What do they have access to once they're there, et cetera?
Yes. So there's some tricks associated with the security component of this, and there's complexity there. But the bottom line is it's actually a very simple thing in the end. So you will go to a website, the Open Innovation Gateway website. You can come to the DIA's innovation page, and you'll find information as it's available associated with how you participate. So a simple link takes you to a place. You apply for a PKI certificate. With a PKI cert, you're in the space. So it's frankly as simple as that. Now, what is the space? What is this environment? There's some tricks associated with making a coherent environment that isn't coherently planned. But the essence of it when you first show up in the space is a wiki. So it's a place where you can interact and you can drop ideas, where you're made aware of the kinds of things and capabilities that are in the space. Underneath that wiki and within that wiki is a description for how a technology provider participates in the space. Again, this time with a service provider, PKI cert, they're able to offer their technologies within the space. They're able to link to a set of core services such that any user who's in the space with their PKI cert can then access, try out their capability and where they can interact with other technology providers in the space. It sounds, as it should, fairly easy for people to get involved, and it is. At its core element. But again, there are some tricks behind the scenes. I could describe them, but that it's not really relevant. It's the end user experience, the technology provider experience, which is I just click in and go.
On the issue of IP protection, once you place your innovation out there, how do you prevent your competitors who are also in this space from seeing it, saying, hey, that's a great idea, I think I'll steal it?
That's right. So, in fact, this is one of those tricks that I mentioned. So built into the space is what I call stakeholder-managed authorization. So there's an underpinning associated with this, a messaging bus that allows you to turn on and turn off any connections coming in to your particular neck of the woods, to your capabilities. So one of the advantages is providers host their own, so they retain complete control of their own capabilities, technologies, configurations, and so on. They're not constrained by other people's way of doing things. But the gateway into their setting, they control through what I call stakeholder-managed authorization. Stakeholder-managed authorization is I'm free to build groups and relationships within the space through, we call it the group management service. It'll probably have a different name going forward, but it's basically this. I can create an environment. Let's say I'm Dandoni Technologies. I can create a group called Dandoni Technologies, and I can invite in specific individuals into that group. Only those folks that I invite in will have access to my specific technologies. There'll be other more formally managed groups, like who is a government employee in the space. And so if I want to let all government employees in, I can add that group to my definition. And that's how you get access. So for a provider in the space, they have complete control over who can access their capabilities. That bridge met sort of an unceremonious end, as it was not considered to be research. So it was doing quite well. It was nominated to be on the White House Innovation Gallery. It was a powerful potential model, but as is often the case, something may be out of place with where it ought to be. So it was there that we worked out the kinks associated with the model, where we really worked through how you get to critical mass in terms of capabilities, users, and use cases. So we're learning a lot from that scenario. That preceded the real growth and the bridge environment, the whole App Store model. And as I mentioned in my presentation earlier, it's that model that is the that really validated this new approach. By that I mean bringing the platform to the innovator instead of the other way around. We know this works. We've seen it work as Apple brought their platform, made it easily accessible to the innovator, and directly connected the innovator with the user in that particular case. Since many folks have followed that model. And so it's that precedent that really gives us confidence that this is a game-changing way to do business. Now, as I mentioned, we're working with other agencies on the specific model. In particular, NRO's got a great model called PlugFest that allows people in it. It's not as wide open as the gateway, but it allows innovators to come together and connect in and connect with one another in the space. We're going to bring those two things together. The hackathon model combined with this open mission environment. And so that's the essence of the gateway. We're going to learn lessons along the way. There will be additional learning, to be sure. And we want to work with industry as much as we can, and we're committed to that, to shape the space and make it exactly the right model to streamline great ideas and their adoption in mission settings. So that's the target. We're going to adapt to get there. I think we have a good plan and a good set of experience to drive what we're doing.
You talk about this idea of critical mass before this really takes hold and reaches its potential in terms of a way to bring innovation into DIA and the IC. Talk about what you mean by critical mass.
Yeah. So critical mass in a tech, you can imagine the early days of Wikipedia. That most of us weren't even aware of it in its early days, so it's hard for us to imagine. But in that particular setting, there's not a strong incentive to come to Wikipedia as a user, right? You come there, and there's just not a lot of content. So it was a few passionate early adopters who helped Wikipedia, who saw the vision and where it was going, helped build content before there was consistent value, until you got to the point where there's plenty of content there, and now suddenly it's a reference source, a place where people frequently come, and where there's an incentive to then contribute and add ideas in the space. It's that first phase that is the hardest part, that requires a great deal of activation energy in order to overcome those barriers. And that's the challenge in this particular setting.
Dan Doney is the Chief Innovation Officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. We'll be back to talk more about the forthcoming Open Innovation Gateway after a quick break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu.
The network is transforming. What's more, it's changing the job descriptions of network managers and even agency IT leaders. Are you keeping up? Join federal IT executives at the 2013 Federal Forum hosted by Brocade as they share their insights and best practices on how to implement and manage federal agency networks of the future. Register today for the complimentary 2013 Federal Forum, August 6th at the Ronald Reagan Building. Do more than keep up. Go to the Federal Forum. Register at federalforum2013.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com. When duty calls, they can help.
When my husband got orders to PCS to Jacksonville, we only had 2 months to sell our home near Quantico and find housing near our new base. We were overwhelmed. Now, make that panic. I'm happy to report we've checked into our new duty station, our daughter is enrolled in school, and we're settled into the perfect home that we found on MilitaryByOwner.com.
Military by Owner. Find, sell, or rent housing near any U.S. military base. Homes advertised by homeowners and real estate agents.
The Guiding You Home Safely Report, provided and paid for by the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
Appropriations bills to fund the Transportation and Housing and Urban Development Departments have passed both the House and Senate committees, both chambers agreeing on $140 million to keep open air traffic control towers, but the overall funding levels are very different. The $44 billion House version is $10 billion less than the Senate version. If the conference committee is unable to iron out a compromise, FAA could be looking at closing control towers, which would mean major delays again at airports in the fall.
Hi, I'm Paul Rinaldi, the president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I've been an air traffic controller for 20 years, and I can tell you it's an intensely rewarding job. The air traffic controllers are proud public servants, safely guiding your flight and 70,000 other flights each day around this great nation. When you fly, we will guide you home with the highest level of safety and professionalism you expect. Visit us at NATCA.org. That's NACA.org.
Would you trust someone with disabilities to test high-tech protective combat gear? Our armed forces do. Source America provides the military with a highly trained, exceptional workforce, people with significant disabilities. In fact, Source America provides vital expertise to thousands of federal customers across the country. For everything from contract closeouts to food service to call center support. Learn more at sourceamerica.org. An Ability One authorized enterprise.
What makes PowerJobs.com powerful? It's you. PowerJobs.com was created for you, the Washington area professional working in federal contracting, nonprofit and association industries, technology, and government relations. PowerJobs.com features thousands of top-level openings from hundreds of the region's leading employers. There's already been 2 million job searches on PowerJobs.com so far this year. Tap into the power of PowerJobs.com, a career site made for you. PowerJobs.com, empowering today's top talent.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Signs, so subtle we may not notice them. Signs like loss of interest in activities. Signs like insomnia, fatigue, or withdrawing from friends.
Hey, dearie, come play cards with us.
Even talking about wanting to die. These are signs of depression.
Hi, my name is Smitty. My husband, Congressman Jerry Connolly, and I urge you to take signs of depression seriously. Let your loved one know you care, then seek help from a doctor or mental health professional.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD. Thanks for listening this week. And we are talking during this part of the show with Dan Doney, the Chief Innovation Officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He says DIA is out to completely reshape the way DIA interacts with industry. Through the Open Innovation Portal it plans to launch this coming winter, innovators in industry, academia, and elsewhere will be able to share their capabilities directly with people performing missions in the intelligence community. And likewise, those IC employees will be able to publish wish lists of capabilities they'd like to have. That would enable them to do their jobs better. Before the break, Doney talked with us about one challenge, the need for that portal to reach what he calls critical mass.
And so you have to achieve that critical mass among whom? The mission people within DIA or among the people who would be contributing innovations into DIA?
It ultimately amounts to both. And so that's what the tricky part about it, because the mission users, people, the buyers in this particular case, why would they come to a space that has no technologies? And why would a technology provider come to a space that has no buyers? So in this new model, as we establish it, first there's a need as the gateway to iSight to have disciplined buyers in this process to truly establish that this is the gateway. This is the way for a technology to get the fast track to make the biggest impact as it comes through the space, and so that there are legitimate and real buyers behind the scenes. With real buyers behind the scenes, the drive for technologists to participate in the space is very real. And you can imagine that draws folks to the space. So there's a bit of commitment. There's a bit of selling here in terms of the value of the model. That, I think, has taken place. I think people understand where this can go and how important it is. And we have a commitment from our leadership to stick to the model.
And this is important. We haven't talked about it yet. Once one of your mission users sees something through that gateway that they really like and want to use within this 30-day time cycle that you're trying to turn around, how do you actually go and acquire that?
So it's going to vary, frankly, based on exactly what we're acquiring on the other space, on the other side of it. So, of course, there is a mission need coupled with funds. Matching the mission need is required in order to bring things in. Now, the general is committed to drive it to creating opportunities to allow us to react financially in ways that are much more agile, so that when we see the things that we need, that we can bring them in. So from the time that those technologies conform to the standards, again, that are in the space in a way that they know that they're there, it then becomes a very quick process to bring that technology to an evaluation setting that mirrors the open setting, where we can do a couple quick checks in terms of what our rules are and the things that we need to ensure are in place. And then we can move to the mission setting. And again, we want those to be as transparent as possible. And then we know that the mission environment emulates those same, exists with those same characteristics. And so we can rapidly move it in that setting. And it is then fielded. It's as simple as that.
And to pull any of this off and make it work, would you need to see any real change to the policies around how the IC or how the government do acquisition?
So, in fact, the policies are not the problem. It is there are tools available to agencies to do acquisition in this particular way. The what's missing from the process is transparency. And so there is it's an onerous process to create a BAA or an RFP. a lot of that process, we do it like it's the first time every time. We can do that once those processes, that the systematic elements in terms of the way that you evaluate ideas as they come in, those are processes that can go in one document, one way of doing business. The next part of it's the critical piece. That is connecting the idea to the right mission element who has a need for that idea. Not with a middleman, not with anyone else in the way, but where the decisions are being made by the folks who actually have a need. That's where the component, I didn't spend a whole lot of time on it, but where the Needopedia concept is such a critical piece. That's where people are placing their needs. And with one that's none of the above, right? So folks can come in with ideas that we didn't know to ask for. But specifically where you have a specific need, something that you are there, you can place it there along with, in a very transparent way, letting industry know that we have this need. Pay attention. It's here. I can say in 3 weeks we're going to evaluate, because now, again, it's fully transparent. Anyone in industry can know what I've put into that space. We'll evaluate the white papers that we get in against that need. So it takes the hard parts out of the process and really focuses on what the core decision pieces are in the process. So by focusing on that, that gives us a great deal more agility in a system that many people think is completely broken. I think it can be fixed. I mean, I don't think it needs to be fixed. I think it can be used in a way that's very effective.
EyeSight being an IC-wide effort, once you're in through the gateway here, how do those two things play together, and what does that do for you as far as getting access to the rest of the IC?
That's right. So what we'll take, the standards that are the entry barriers to the space. Well, so I should be clear. PKI CERT is the only true barrier to entry. Once you're in, there's then a sequence of steps that you go through in order to prove your readiness to graduate from the space. So those are what we call conformance checks. Those conformance checks are, we expose the essence of the EyeSight environment in this case. We know that things need to be virtualizable. We know that they need to be elastic. We know that they need to conform to our authentication and authorization standards. We publish them and, in fact, provide service endpoints which mirror the mission environment in the space, such that folks are developing against this. Those standards are driven by EyeSight. So when you conform in the space, that means you conform not just to the DIA environment, to anywhere, but rather to anywhere in the across EyeSight. So it means you're not just used here, but you're used across this common baseline set of elements. You're eligible to be used in any setting.
And I guess my last thing is, where are we on timelines here? Is this pie in the sky at this point, or do we have hard deadlines when we're going to see this implemented?
Yeah, so we're estimating the IOC of the space, allowing in users of the gateway, in December of this year. Now, that's not a hard promise, and we're working it now. We're just getting going on standing this up. As I mentioned, we've done this before. I understand the essential elements. There's a little bit more doing it at this scale. So I believe we'll be there around December. But we're committed. I'm here on a short tenure. I'm only here for 2 years. And I've got a lot of goals, as you can tell. I'm committed to achieving those goals, so we're moving as quickly as possible, and leadership supports where we're headed. I expect that by next year's Innovation Day, we have a very different engagement where folks are showcasing their capabilities in the gateway. We have a set of stretch goals, which are really driving our behaviors. But I want to emphasize this point that the general hit on it as well. Innovation is a means, not an end. So we're driven by mission. And so the bottom line is, how much better are we able to execute on our mission? Not whether or not we are the best innovators in the world. So however you would define innovation and however you would measure is not the important question. The question is, how much are they able to do their jobs better? So that's where our metrics start on this. It's a mistake that many folks make, is they measure the means instead of the ends. So I do want to emphasize that piece. That said, there are specific stretch goals that are driving our activities. One of those is this rapid technology transition, the 30-day transition requirement that forces us to reform those five areas: discovery, evaluation, integration, accreditation, and acquisition. We've got to reform all those in order to be able to move things in quickly. Another stretch goal that I talked about is scaling up the innovation successes that we see in sales to the whole enterprise. And there we see three characteristics in the enterprise that we really need to emulate. We see three characteristics in specific cells that lead to success, but that we need to emulate across the enterprise. So those are the existence of cross-functional teams where technologists, analysts, and collectors are able to work together, and analysts of all sorts of different types are able to work together on mission challenges. Mission-driven cross-functional teams, that's one. The second piece is access to tools, rapid access to capabilities, with the ability to modify those capabilities. So you're not stuck with whatever the enterprise decides to give you in the space. The third piece is access to mission-relevant data. We're working on improved mechanisms that give us both better access and better control. And we know that we need to improve in that particular area. This stakeholder-managed authorization piece, frankly, is an element of reform that can be applied to the way that we protect our data as well.
Dan Doney is the Chief Innovation Officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He talked with us about DIA's Open Innovation Portal during the agency's annual Innovation Day at their headquarters here in Washington. We'll take a short break and then switch gears to the Air Force Space Command. We'll hear from its commander about the latest from the Air Force in space and cyberspace. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
The Cybersecurity Report is brought to you by University of Maryland University College.
Law enforcement and first responders got a special bulletin recently warning them that terrorists frequent popular social media sites to gather pre-operational surveillance. Some cyber terrorists are sophisticated enough to penetrate an organization's network and gather personal, sensitive, or proprietary data. Virtual tours, security procedures, even business hours are key sources of information for terrorists. I'm J.J. Green.
Secure your future with a bachelor's or master's degree in cybersecurity, available entirely online from University of Maryland University College. Their programs have been specially developed by experts from government and private industry, so you'll get the real-world skills you need for your career. Plus, UMUC is designated as a National Center of Academic Excellence in Information Assurance Education by NSA and DHS. University of Maryland University College. Call 800-888-UMUC or visit umuc.edu/cybersecurity. Security.
The awards and opportunities of modernizing federal IT networks. A panel discussion with experts from government and industry, sponsored by Brocade. And now panelist Wolf Tombe, Chief Technology Officer for Customs and Border Patrol.
You talk about cloud, mobile, big data, all of those intrinsically rely on the network. All that's great, but if you don't have a network, you can't get to any of it. So the network has to evolve. It has to evolve very, very quickly, and it has to evolve in a proactive way that meets this 24/7, always connected, no matter where you are, no matter when, environment that the users are demanding.
The network is transforming. Join federal IT executives at the 2013 Federal Forum hosted by Brocade as they share their insights and best practices on how to implement and manage federal agency networks of the future. August 6th at the Ronald Reagan Building. Register today for the complimentary Federal Forum at federalforum2013.com. Federalforum2013.com.
Each day, over 49 million Americans live in households that experience hunger, including 17 million children. Johnson's Florist and Garden Centers want to help. They're asking gardeners in the Washington area to plant extra this growing season, and at harvest time, bring that extra to one of their stores in D.C., Kensington, and Olney, Maryland. All donations will go to a local organization that feeds the hungry. Visit johnsonsflorist.com to learn more about the Plant a Row for the Hungry initiative. johnsonsflorist.com.
VMware Solutions help governments transform their IT departments into efficient, flexible enterprises that can respond faster to the needs of policymakers, agencies, and constituents while reducing IT infrastructure and operating costs. Virtualization provides government organizations with an evolutionary path to cloud computing that preserves existing IT investments, security, and control. Learn more at thevirtualizationexpert.com. VMware, IT solutions for transforming government.
Please join Jim Fleisig on Tuesday, July 23rd at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum, Cybersecurity Progress and Best Practices. The panel includes government leaders from the Coast Guard, the Department of Energy, and the Department of the Treasury. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum Tuesday, July 23rd at 12 noon right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by HP, McAfee, and SourceFire.
The year was 1954, and the Russians were celebrating May Day by parading their new bomber through Red Square. But was this display of military might real, or just for show? To find out, America needed a new set of eyes in the sky. So the team at Lockheed Skunk Works swung into action, and in a mere 9 months, did the impossible by delivering the U-2 Dragon Lady. A revolutionary aircraft that could fly higher than Soviet anti-air defenses and soak up intelligence like a sponge. As time marched on and the Soviet Union faded, the U-2 kept on flying, growing in aircraft size and capability, taking on an ever-expanding range of missions and confounding the skeptics who said it wouldn't last long. Today, the U-2 remains a vital national asset. The story is revealed at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Let the Federal News Radio Budget Tracker help you follow your agency's funding bill all the way through Congress. Find it at FederalNewsRadio.com, search term Budget Tracker.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. We spent the front end of the hour this week talking with Dan Doney, DIA's Chief Innovation Officer, about the agency's revised approach to its interaction with industry and bringing new technologies on board. We'll post the whole show at federalnewsradio.com if you're just joining us. But we'll switch now to the Air Force and its current plans for space and cyberspace. General William Shelton, the commander of Air Force Space Command, addressed those issues during a talk before a small gathering organized by the Air Force Association on Capitol Hill this week.
I also want to tell you that I'm tired of talking about bad news all the time. Seems like all the news is bad, so I'm going to spend most of my time talking about things that are good within Air Force and cyber, within the Air Force and the space and cyber business. Seems like we're talking about budgets and sequestration and sexual assault and all these other issues that are just really kind of bad news, and I'm tired of talking about that. But you got to give me one rant here for a second. I'm also extremely tired of reading about articles in various publications that there is no impact to sequestration. Let me assure you, there are plenty of impacts to sequestration. And those that are writing those articles, those that are saying that there is no impact and the sky has not fallen and so on and so forth, I would like for them to come live with me for a couple of days and try to make ends meet on budgets that just don't close. To the end of the fiscal year here, I know I'm probably about $4 or $5 million short just getting to the end of the year. So how we're going to scrape up $4 or $5 million to make it to the end of the year, much less make it through another year of sequestration in 14. No impact. No impact. Let me assure you, there is plenty of impact. And you know, when I've got civilians that are out taking a 20% pay cut for the remainder of the year, and I lose not only the 20%, that's tragic enough, but we lose the productivity of those civilians as well and their contribution to national defense for the remainder of the fiscal year. That is horrific. I stood in front of my civilians the other day, and I apologized to them, and I said, your government has let you down, and that's how I feel about it. We have let them down. We have broken faith with our civilian workforce. So anyway, enough of that. Enough of my rant. So what's going well in space and cyber, and a little peek into our future as well? I think I said this repeatedly over the last couple of years, but it's worth repeating. Let me say it one more time. Space and cyber capabilities are absolutely foundational to how we do business in the United States military today. You can talk about the entire spectrum of conflict. You can talk about operations from humanitarian relief all the way through major combat operations. You can talk about tactical operations all the way through the strategic. You can talk about the soldier in the foxhole all the way to the President of the United States. There's a dependency on space and cyber capability that we really can't think about removing. So with that in mind, what are we doing to ensure that we will continue to have that capability now and into the future? Well, let me start with cyber. I'll tell you, our 24th Air Force down at Lackland Air Force Base is doing an absolutely superb job of operating and defending Air Force networks to provide the warfighting capability we need. There are literally millions of probes every day on defense networks. And what you don't hear, you hear about the penetrations that get through. What you don't hear about is about those millions that are repelled. And again, tremendous work by our folks doing that. We're also collapsing down to a single Air Force network called the AFNET. That's our number one cyber priority, is getting collapsed down to that single network. The reason we're doing that is there are now just 16 touch points to the external world, if you will, to the Internet within the Air Force. That's much easier to defend. It's much more consolidated from a command and control perspective. It also allows us much more flexibility. Once we get this migration completed, I can go from base X to base Y, slip my CAT card into a computer on base Y, and it's just like I'm at home. So there's a lot of flexibility. There's much better defendability of our networks, and it's going to be great once we get it completed this next year. And it's, by the way, just in time for inclusion into the joint information environment. You've heard a lot about JIE, probably. JIE, the Air Force has been accused of being a little bit recalcitrant on JIE. That's not the case, but there's a fair amount of due diligence that we wanted to do, both from a technical perspective and from a business case perspective. We're working our way through this. You'll see some announcements in the not-too-distant future about progress that we've made. But just trust me when I say that the Air Force is very committed to JIE, but we want to make sure we do it in the right way. We want to make sure that it's an architecture that we can live with. We're also standing up additional cyber mission teams in support of U.S. Cyber Command. You've probably seen that reported as well. U.S. Cyber Command wants to stand up these national and combatant command mission teams to support cyber operations, and particularly looking at offensive cyber operations. So we're in the middle of that process. The Air Force demand for that is going to be somewhere around 1,500 or so people. We will stand up a project task force, a PROTAF, to do this in a smart way. There are a very disciplined, rigorous way. There are certainly Title 10, Title 50 U.S. Code kinds of issues here related to SIGINT authorities and those kinds of things. So we'll work our way very carefully through this to make sure that we've stood up the right kind of teams and that we're doing right by U.S. Cyber Command and by the Air Force. You've also read about us establishing cyber weapons systems. And again, something I need to set the record straight on. They aren't really weapon systems. But, you know, if you're going to do a normal process within the Air Force, you have to declare something a weapon system. And then it comes with all those standard processes and standard funding. Too long, we've had kind of special funding relationships for our cyber capabilities. And frankly, it's caused us to run short on money. It's resulted in end-of-year fixes to programs as opposed to normal sustainment. So we've set aside these six programs. We call them weapon systems. They are not in any way weapons, but we've called them that so that we can get them into the standard sustainment process. Just part of the business of normalizing cyber in the United States Air Force and trying to get it on the same level as air and space in terms of support for those capabilities.
That's General William Shelton, the commander of Air Force Space Command. Back with a bit more from him after a quick break on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia.
Please join Max Kakis, defense editor of Signal Magazine, on Friday, July 19th at 2:05 p.m. for a new installment of AFCEA Answers. Max will be joined by a panel of government and industry professionals to discuss cloud computing. The panel will include Terry Halverson, CIO, Department of the Navy. Don't miss AFCEA Answers with Max Kakis on Friday, July 19th at 2:05 p.m. right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by AFCEA International and brought to you by HP and Intel.
Life is filled with uncertainty, military life especially. AFMA can help you breathe easy through it all. Since 1879, AFMA has helped military families with low-cost military life insurance and the best survivor assistance. We're experts at helping you manage the complexities of military life and securing your family's financial well-being. Call 1-877-398-2263 today or go to AAFMAA.com to see how we can help you.
Here's Tommy Huang, CIO Merit Systems Protection Board, on the Real Deal on Digital Government panel sponsored by Accenture.
All this has really worked out well. So one example is during Hurricane Sandy, for instance, when the D.C. government shut down, we were able to have employees support our other regional offices that were still operating and needed support from us, and they were able to do that from home, teleworking through the mobility access.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Accenture, high performance delivered. It's how we help clients take on their most complex challenges. We helped process $650 billion in benefit payments for U.S. federal organizations. And we helped eliminate $348 million in U.S. federal fleet, inventory, and freight costs. With unmatched capabilities across defense, public safety, and civilian, Accenture consistently delivers results at speed. To learn more, visit Accenture.com/federal or follow us on Twitter at Accenture Fed.
The Guiding You Home Safely Report, provided and paid for by the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
Appropriations bills to fund the Transportation and Housing and Urban Development Departments have passed both the House and Senate committees, both chambers agreeing on $140 million to keep open air traffic control towers, but the overall funding levels are very different. The $44 billion House version is $10 billion less than the Senate version. If the conference committee is unable to iron out a compromise, FAA could be looking at closing control towers, which would mean major delays again at airports in the fall.
Hi, I'm Trish Gilbert, Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I've been an air traffic controller for more than 21 years. I chose this career because it gave me the chance to do something very important. Air traffic controllers like me take great pride in working hard to ensure the safety of 70,000 flights a day in U.S. airspace. We strive to reach the highest level of professionalism. So on your next flight, sit back and relax. We'll guide you home safely. Visit NATCA.org.
Recently on Federal News Radio's Federal Tech Talk, sponsored by AT&T.
We are speaking with Steve Charles, co-founder Emix Group. We are talking about supplier quality management for federal agencies.
Tracking where things come from and that traceability is the bedrock principle here that we need to be able to apply to every product that's currently in production. It is what the government is expecting. It's what the statute expects, and it's what we're doing with our Trusted Supplier Program.
Secure Mobile Government is here.
Evaluate a department budget at a metro station.
You can now work out in the field with a smartphone and the safety and security of the AT&T network. AT&T extends the cyber defense perimeter of your agency's mobile workforce.
Study new employment stats while teleworking.
Your security is predictive and preventive. Go to att.com/gov/secure to learn how AT&T mobile security can safely connect you to both your agency and constituents. AT&T. Rethink possible.
The Federal News Radio United Way Charity of the Month is Our House, an organization that serves America's forgotten children, boys, abused, abandoned, orphaned, homeless. Our House provides them a home, an education, job skills, and hope. Help give a child a future at the Our House Fundraiser Gala, Friday, September 20th, in the Lockheed Martin lobby of the Music Center at Strathmore in Bethesda. For more info, visit federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Radio charities are fed by Papa John's.
This is Mark Amtower. For 27 years, I've advised hundreds of large and small contractors on the best marketing tactics to reach key government buyers and influencers. Collectively, my clients have made billions of dollars by maximizing the value of their contracts. If you need to maximize the value of your GSA schedule, GWAC, or IDIQ, or you need to raise your overall visibility in the government market, we need to talk. Make certain your marketing budget pays major dividends. Contact me at federaldirect.net.
Welcome back to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We talked earlier in the hour with Dan Doney, DIA's Chief Innovation Officer, about a new way of bringing innovation into the Defense Intelligence Agency. We're hearing now, as we close out the show, from General William Shelton, the commander of Air Force Space Command. He gave a presentation to a small gathering organized by the Air Force Association about space and cyberspace on Capitol Hill.
Let me switch to space now, and I'm going to work from geosynchronous orbit down in terms of programs. That's kind of the way I think about it, so it helps me when we're talking about it to think about orbital regimes. Start with the space-based infrared system. We've got two satellites on orbit now. We've had some hiccups, admittedly, with the first satellite. We've got the second one on orbit. It seems to be doing a little bit better. But a lot of infant issues on the first satellite. It's been up about 2 years. We're still wringing out the sensors. We're still trying to understand how this thing operates on orbit. So a lot of work still to do. We are on contract for SBIRS through vehicle number 6, and there are some really hard decisions we're going to have to make after vehicle 6. So vehicle 6 will take us through kind of the mid-2020 timeframe. As we look out into the future and we see threats from other nations coming to the fore here, it's a very different space environment that we're operating in today. It will be very different 5 years from now than what it is today. So are we going to continue on the path we're on with some of our high-priority satellites? If you think about SBIRS in context, what is it designed for? It is designed to operate in some of the most difficult circumstances the United States might ever face. It is designed to provide warning of strategic attack on the United States. That being the case, you want it to be survivable. And with the threats that are coming, we don't believe that SBIRS in its current incarnation will be survivable past the mid-2020s. So we believe this calls for a different kind of capability, perhaps a disaggregated capability where you take the strategic missile warning and the tactical missile warning and separate it onto different satellites. That's one path. Perhaps you can host some of these infrared sensors on other platforms. That's another path. So we are in the process of studying these various paths, alternative architectures that we might decide to pursue. And what are called Space Modernization Initiative funds are designed to do just that, to explore these alternative architectures and see what we think will work best in the new threat environment and also in the new budget environment we're in. Wideband Global Satellite. Jeff Trouberman and I were just talking about this. We're just about to launch the 6th satellite. So we've got 5 of these on orbit. We've got contracts out through vehicle number 10. International involvement in this program as well. People have bought into the capability of the broader WGS architecture. And all these satellites are working extremely well. And it's lots of bandwidth. Lots of bandwidth. I mean, a single WGS satellite is more bandwidth than the entire constellation of the Defense Satellite Communication System, DISCUS, its predecessor. Single satellite, the entire constellation of DISCUS before it. But it's still not enough. I mean, there's just an insatiable demand for satellite bandwidth. So the question for us in the future is, how do we satisfy all that bandwidth demand? Do we do that through a continuation of dedicated military satellites? Is it a service that we contract for? Is it a lease-to-buy kind of thing? Again, lots of alternative architectures that we need to look at here. But what we don't think is a smart way to go is how we're doing business right now, which is buying bandwidth on the spot market, so to speak. 80% of our traffic, satellite communications traffic coming back from Southwest Asia, comes over commercial assets right now. And we are buying that in piece parts, which is absolutely the most expensive way to do it. So lots of work to do. Advanced extremely high-frequency satellites, AEHF. This is the satellite that provides the president the capability to communicate with deployed forces when there's a nuclear environment, either nuclear attack in progress or post-nuclear attack when the atmosphere is scintillated from the nuclear effects. It is the satellite, again, that just has to be there. It is designed specifically so that the president can have that kind of communications capability. So again, in this new threatened environment, does it make sense to keep going down the path that we're on for advanced EHF? Just like SBIRS, we're through satellite number 6 in terms of contracted actions, again, through the mid-2020s or so. But we've got to find alternatives that are much more resilient to certainly the environment and are much more affordable. A single advanced EHF satellite is a multi-billion-dollar satellite. In this budget climate, is that really where we want to be? And I would say it's not. So what's our future in light of the threats and in light of the budget environment? We'll spend those Space Modernization Initiative funds smartly to get to that answer. GPS, 31 satellites on orbit right now, performing extremely well. This constellation just keeps on ticking. Having a little trouble with the new ground system that we're developing. We're trying to get that back on track. A little phase problem between, back up just a second. In terms of the terminals and ground systems for satellites, we contract for those separately. There was a time when we put those together into a single program. The decision was made that that's just too large a management effort, so we separate them into different contracts. But the problem that has caused is they can get out of phase. So you end up with capability on orbit and the terminals on the ground not being ready. Or you end up with satellites that are ready and go up, and the ground system's not quite ready. So that's where we're going to be with GPS-3. Our first couple of GPS-3 launches will probably go before the ground system designed for GPS-3 is actually ready. But we'll have capability in place, kind of bridge capability, to get us to the place where we can fly GPS-3 and while we wait for the full ground system to come on. We're on contract with GPS-3 through satellite number 8. 9 and out is now a question mark for, again, these alternative architecture ideas. Could we design, for example, a navigation-only small satellite that provides nav capability, but the nuclear detonation detection system that also flies on GPS-3 maybe is sparsely populated in the constellation, so not every GPS satellite has to have an NDS payload. That's an alternative. Could we do NDS as a free flyer? That's another alternative. So a lot of these things being studied. We'll see how we do with GPS 9 and out, but that GPS 3, 9 and out, that has to be decided probably within the next year or so.
General William Shelton is the commander of Air Force Space Command. You heard him there talking to a small gathering on Capitol Hill organized by the Air Force Association about space and cyberspace earlier this week. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Dan Doney, the chief innovation officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. If you missed any of this week's show, we'll post it all at federalnewsradio.com/Jared Serbia. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of On DoD. Glad you could join us. We'll be back again for another episode next week. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.